Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents All Money is Not Created Equal, How Entrepreneurs Can Crack the Code to Getting the Right Funding for Their Startup, by David A. Sprang, narrated by Walter Dixon. Foreword. David and I were first introduced more than 10 years ago by Max von Bismarck, who was then head of Investors Industry Group for the World Economic Forum, WEF. Max suggested that David and I collaborate in organizing a reception for finance and business leaders during the WEF annual meeting in Davos. Ever since, we've been hosting an annual party that's acquired a reputation for being an event where great wine and even greater ideas flow in abundance. I'm pretty sure, given the caliber of people who attend the World Economic Forum, the ideas would come anyhow, but the wine sure doesn't hurt. On the surface, David and I aren't an obvious pair. David is low-key and understated. He is the kind of whip-smart guy who doesn't need to let you know right away just how smart he is and will slay you with funny stories that you just don't see coming. He is level-headed, even-keeled, and nobody's fool. I like and admire all those things about him. On the other hand, it would be fair to say that reticence and reserve are not qualities I possess in abundance. If you're looking for proof that opposites attract, come to our next party at Davos. Deep down, though, what David and I share, in addition to an appreciation of good wine, is an entrepreneurial spirit and a desire to help other companies grow and prosper. We both started out in investment banking, which gives you a great overview of how companies and fortunes are made, and yes, often lost. Over the years, we each forged our own paths in the financial world. David eventually landed in the world of venture debt. In just a few years, his firm, Runway Growth Capital, has acquired a reputation for helping companies grow and increase in value while allowing founders to keep a greater percentage of their equity. As a guy who has built his own businesses, I know how important it is to be judicious about where your money comes from, under what terms, and at what juncture in your business. And I can definitely appreciate the idea of helping founders hold on to more ownership of the companies they've created. In this book, David has taken what he has learned as an investment banker, a venture capitalist, and a growth lender to give founders and would-be entrepreneurs a masterclass in the key things they need to know about funding for startups. I don't know of any other book that touches on so many aspects of funding or does so in a way that is both deft and efficient. David is ethical, fair, reasonable, and can see beyond the square box that debt is often conscribed to. He is a firm believer that business can, and should, be a win-win proposition. He helps make it that way. I didn't yet know David when I wrote my book, Goodbye, Gordon Gekko, How to Find Your Fortune Without Losing Your Soul. But I could have been writing about him. In a sense, I feel like I did. He isn't about transactions, but partnership, and, if you're really lucky, friendship. I'm one of the lucky ones, because I call him my friend. Anthony Scaramucci, founder and co-managing partner of Skybridge Capital. Introduction. Venture capital, VC, is often seen as the holy grail for founders with a big idea for their company. Having a great idea for a business is the start, but it isn't enough. You need capital to bring your idea to fruition. The quest for money to keep a dream and a business alive can be as consuming and stressful as the search for the technological breakthrough or market niche that will make a business viable and valuable. As you follow your dream, raising money is like walking a tightrope. One wrong step can be fatal. Money, like everything else of value, comes at a price. For founders, the price often ends up being too high. In my 30 years of helping companies get the money they need to grow, I've seen too many really smart, hard-working entrepreneurs end up with too little to show for their blood, toil, tears, and sweat. Multiple rounds of equity investment from venture capitalists, VCs, can leave them with ownership stakes diluted to the point where they end up owning just a small fraction of the company they founded. Reduced ownership stakes mean less profit for founders, as well as for early-stage employees who trade low salaries for the promise of small equity stakes. It also means less control, less say in how a company is run, and less voice in its future, which could be an IPO, a sale to a strategic buyer, a merger, an acquisition of another company, or shutting down. In my experience, the loss of control is often what disappoints and frustrates founders most. Entrepreneurs are driven by more than money. Vision and purpose are what propel them to attempt the improbable and to keep going on a path that is challenging at best. Entrepreneurs aren't doomed to dilution and disappointment. There is more than one way to finance growth, and that's what I mean when I say all money is not created equal. The disparity in what different forms of financing can mean has profound implications for founders. Yet too little is known about all the forms of financing. Venture capital garners the most attention and share of mind, and it is the primary form of financing after a very early point in a company's life cycle. But venture capital isn't the only choice, and it may not be the optimal one, especially at each step it's available. My goal in writing this book is to help founders understand the various options for financing and how each could impact their business. To people outside the somewhat cloistered world of Silicon Valley, the multi-million, sometimes billion-dollar figures that get thrown around are unimaginable. I'm using Silicon Valley, not just literally but also figuratively, as it's as much a specific place as a stand-in for anywhere that has a vibrant innovation ecosystem. New York, Seattle, Boston, Austin, etc. But these valuations aren't arbitrary. They're based on sophisticated methodologies that take into account intellectual property, current revenue, projections about growth and scalability, future profitability, and risk. Risk is how venture capitalists justify getting so much equity, the amount of risk they take on being proportional to the potential reward. That's a fair point. But making sure investors who take risk early on get handsomely rewarded and allowing entrepreneurs to keep more control of their companies is not an either-or proposition. This isn't a criticism of venture capitalists or the fundamentals of the venture capital model. Many of the companies that have changed the way we live, work, communicate, and function in every aspect of our lives, individually and collectively, in business-to-business, B2B, and business-to-consumer, B2C, would not have succeeded without venture capital. That's especially true of companies that have been formed within the past 30 years. Venture capitalists are essential to the success of the U.S. innovation ecosystem, not only because of the money they provide, but also for the business acumen, connections, and cachet they bring to fledgling companies. For many years, I was a venture capitalist, so I say this with conviction. Forbes put me on their Midas list of the most successful VCs several years running. My former colleagues and I did work I am proud of. I loved sitting on the boards of startup companies and helping entrepreneurs succeed. There was a rush knowing that the businesses we were financing could make a real difference. But along the way, I started to see that there was another way to help startups get much-needed capital, and that's through debt. Debt can take several forms. It can be a loan against accounts receivable and/or inventory, an asset-based loan, ABL, an advance on predictable revenue, such as monthly recurring revenue, MRR, a percentage of future, less predictable revenue, a revenue-based loan, RBL, or in the form of venture debt, loans to venture-backed companies that have yet to reach profitability. This can happen at almost any stage at which a company would consider taking venture capital. My company, Runway Growth Capital, makes loans to later stage, pre-profit companies. Using debt as an alternative to, or in conjunction with, raising additional venture capital is an unfamiliar concept to many people, and consequently, it isn't used often enough. To be clear, venture capital and venture capitalists, i.e. VCs, refer to people providing equity to startups in exchange for an ownership stake in the company. Venture debt and venture lenders refer to providing loans, which result in less dilution. Debt, like just about any other financial instrument, can be a lever used to propel something forward, or it can be a hammer brought down with enough force to be destructive. Taking debt at the appropriate time, under the right terms, from someone you've vetted as carefully as they've vetted you, can open a world of possibilities for you and your business. While finalizing the manuscript for this book, something unthinkable happened. Silicon Valley Bank failed and was taken over by the FDIC following a run on the bank. Thousands of startups and VCs had rushed to withdraw their cash out of SVB amid worries that the bank's assets, severely impaired as a result of rapidly rising interest rates, would not be sufficient to cover its liabilities. This will undoubtedly change the landscape and impact the way that startups are funded and manage their financial affairs. There will be more on this later in the book, and you will be able to find ongoing updates on the book's website. I understand the pressures entrepreneurs face, worrying about meeting payroll, wondering if others will buy into your vision, and navigating the internal struggle between being convinced you have a great idea and being frustrated with the time it can take to nurture a growing company to success. While I have never run a technology startup, I have started several businesses as well as a number of investment funds. I've had to face wrenching decisions about which team members to let go, how much risk I and the remaining team could and should continue to absorb, and there have been times that I've wondered whether it was all worth it. I've lost enough money to keep me awake at night and paid heavy prices personally, losing time with my children, enduring stress on my relationships, and seeing friendships suffer, either because I was too busy or because of the complications that arise when you inevitably become friends with people with whom you work. My own experiences have given me valuable insights into the issues founders face, personally and professionally, and that's why I'm confident that this book will be helpful to you, regardless of what stage you and your business are at. If you've got an idea locked somewhere in your brain that you haven't brought to the surface yet, this will help you navigate the entire financial journey. If you're in the formative stage, still looking for your first funding, this book will be useful, because it's never too soon to start thinking about how to fund the scale-up that comes after the startup. And if you've been around for a while, with a promising but still not profitable business, it's definitely time for you to think about alternatives for financing. Doing the same kind of deal again and again, taking dilutive rounds of venture capital, might not be the best solution for you and your business. In All Money Is Not Created Equal, I'll give you an overview of the startup world, a look at the ecosystem, how money moves through it, how to evaluate capitalization options, and how to assess as a funding partner. And I will help you understand the implications of different types of money. Throughout the book, I'll be sharing my own experiences, such as bringing part of Runway Growth Capital public, as well as including stories about companies and deals that will bring various points to life. You'll also find a glossary of words and phrases commonly used in the world of startups and VCs. You won't find advice on how to be a great leader or the latest thinking in management. There are scores of excellent books already written on how to manage your team. But I will tell you what to be aware of as you build your team and offer advice on how to manage yourself, what you need to think about, consider, and be aware of along the way in the context of how these things can affect funding, financial stability, and your startup's potential for growth. You'll find useful information rather than advice. My goal is to teach, not preach. The book is organized into sections with easily digestible chapters, and key points are summarized at the end of each chapter. While I hope that you will listen to the entire chapter and the whole book, these summaries can help you decide which chapters will be of the most immediate interest and use to you. You'll find some repetition of explanations throughout the book, which was intentional, knowing that the book may be consumed in phases. You'll notice that once I've introduced someone, instead of subsequently referring to them by their last name, I've opted for the rather unorthodox practice of referring to them by their first names. These people are partners, friends, colleagues. It seems impersonal to me to refer to them otherwise. This book will help you understand that all money is not created equal, and what the implications of that idea are for you and your business. Part 1. Setting the Stage. Chapter 1. A Tale of Two Companies. To help you better understand the difference between venture capital and venture debt, I'm going to start with a fictitious case study about the choices two growing companies made for getting capital. Throughout this book, as much as possible, I'll be using lessons drawn from actual companies and my own experiences, even though I may be masking the actual identities of the companies and individuals involved. For the sake of simplicity, I am inventing two fictional examples. We'll call them Four Paws and 1939. You'll be seeing more about these two made-up companies throughout the book. In some instances, it will not be appropriate to use actual financial details from real companies. In other cases, examples from real companies would make those companies too easily identified. Recently, biotech has been one of the hottest areas in VC, but it wasn't as hot in the first decade of the 21st century when our two imaginary companies were founded. However, there were some big real-life winners in those years. 23andMe, the popular genetics company, was started in 2006. Acceleron Pharma was founded in 2003, went public 10 years later, and was acquired by Merck & Company in 2021 for $11.5 billion. And Stemcentrix was founded in 2008, and less than 10 years later was sold to AbbVie for $5.8 billion. Our fictitious companies, Four Paws Corporation and 1939 Incorporated, were veterinary biotechs. 1939 took its name from the fact that cats have 19 sets of chromosomes and dogs have 39. The companies had similar goals: to maximize the amount of information that could be learned about cats and dogs from their genetic material and determine which information would be most valuable and to whom. Joshua Nickerson, founder of Four Paws, and Jens Lay, founder of 1939, had a friendly rivalry. They had worked together in senior positions at Damascene Sciences, an early, also fictional, biotech success in Silicon Valley, where they both had been early employees. Both Nickerson and Lay initiated operations in 2006 using their own savings, including money made from option grants of Damascene stock as seed money. Their own significant investments allowed them to avoid going the typical friends and family route and/or raising initial capital from seed and angel investors, luxuries real-life founders seldom have. After brief ramp-up periods, where the founders continued to self-fund their companies, both companies completed their Series A rounds in 2007, with each raising $5 million at $10 million pre-money valuation, for post-funding valuation figures of $15 million each. In venture speak, pre-money valuation plus new money equals post-money valuation. So, in the cases of Four Paws and 1939, the VC investors paid $5 million to own 33.33% of each company, $5 million of new money being 33.33% of the post-money valuation of $15 million. Nickerson and Lay each owned 33.33% of their respective companies, with the remaining one-third of each company allocated or reserved for current and future employees, either directly or through the employee stock option pool. By 2012, after 5 years and two more rounds of venture funding, each company had shown promising results with the analysis that could be done with just one vial of blood from either a cat or a dog. Information about likely disease markers and preventive medicines and changes in diet proved to be valuable to veterinarians, pet insurers, and pet owners. Some listeners will, rightly, point out that they have seen valuations between rounds increase much faster than in our examples. We are being conservative and attempting to model normal times. Obviously, the higher the valuation, the less dilution to founders, management, and early investors. However, the dangers of raising equity capital at inflated, unsupportable, and unrealistic valuations are well known and far outweigh the short-term gratification of a silly valuation. Considering that spending on cats and dogs was estimated to be at least $50 billion per year at the time, and by 2018 was expected to grow to approximately $72 billion, both companies were attracting attention from investment bankers and potential acquirers, ranging from pet insurers to veterinary pharma companies to pet food companies. In 2013, neither company was yet profitable, and each raised its Series D round of financing and further refined its scope of research. Four Paws was looking for ways to monetize the data it had already collected to generate more revenue. Nickerson hoped that eventually Four Paws could collect enough data to be able to figure out what diet changes could help both prevent and treat diseases in animals and prolong their lives, using food as medicine. 2 years later, in 2015, Four Paws had reached a crossroads. Nickerson could see that profitability was years away, and the company had made little progress on proving the validity of the idea of food as medicine. The tests and the resulting reports were expensive for consumers, and pet insurers had yet to be convinced to pick up the costs of either the tests or the reports. One of the venture investors had hoped that lobbying efforts with the insurance companies would result in this change in coverage, but pet insurers remained leery. Weighing the options, including taking additional VC money and recognizing the costs and risks of continuing along a path of unknown duration, Nickerson and his 7-member board, consisting of 4 VCs, 2 independent directors, and Nickerson, who was the chairman and CEO, decided to sell Four Paws. The VCs were no longer convinced that Four Paws had blockbuster potential, meaning raising additional capital would have been difficult. Four Paws was sold for $100 million to the fictional Unicorn Pet Food Company. The aspirationally and prophetically named Unicorn had been founded in 1997. After going public in 2007, it had grown consistently through shrewd acquisitions. Nickerson, who still owned an 11% stake in Four Paws after 4 rounds of venture capital, received consideration of $10 million in cash. Fortunately, Nickerson had negotiated with his VC investors to have their investment be in the form of non-participating preferred stock versus participating preferred stock, which gives the VCs their money back and then their share based on ownership percentage of proceeds above their investment. This method almost treats the preferred stock as debt in the sense that it must be repaid before profits are allocated among the owners. You can see why it's called double dipping. During this same time frame, 1939 had gone in a different direction. In 2012, 1939 had started selling cat food Feelin' Fine through veterinary practices and at high-end animal boutiques. Although the food was not yet clinically proven to neutralize dander and reduce allergic reactions in humans, studies with both humans and cats looked promising. And anecdotal information among the cat-owning community suggested the food did indeed have a dander-dampening effect. While 1939 made no such claims about the food, it certainly benefited from the endorsement by the vocal online cat-owning community, which swore to Feelin' Fine's allergen-reducing powers. The company decided to narrow its focus to cats, as that line of research was also proving more promising than research connected to dogs. Also, sales of Feelin' Fine were surging because of its presumed and proclaimed, but not yet proven, benefits regarding allergies. Lay's company also became an acquisition target for Unicorn Pet Food. Like Four Paws, 1939 was not yet profitable. At the time of the offer from Unicorn in 2015, 1939 was valued at approximately $85 million. Lay was confident that proving the science behind neutralizing cat dander was close, and that selling for $85 million would mean leaving many, many millions on the table. Plus, $85 million was lower than the valuation of his most recent round of venture capital, and he didn't want to disappoint his investors. The quest for the dander-neutralizing agent had been and would continue to be expensive, but Lay and his board also knew that, if found, it would be a game-changer. In 2015, there were an estimated 86.4 million cats living in U.S. households, and given the prevalence of cat allergies, the market potential for Feelin' Fine was enormous. There was also the idea that 1939 could sell adjacent products for feline fans, other kinds of cat food, cat litter, and cat accessories, including furniture such as climbing posts and beds. The challenge was making sure that the ingredient that neutralized Fel-D1, the protein that is the primary source of allergens, would be seen as a food additive and not as a medicine. If it remained as a food additive, it would be widely available to cat owners without the expense of going to a veterinarian and getting a prescription, and the food itself would be available without a prescription. As the company considered Unicorn's buyout offer, as well as the risks and rewards of remaining independent, one of 1939's VC board members, Laura Tate, suggested that Lay explore venture debt to fund the company and allow it to remain independent, as opposed to taking on another round of venture capital. Additional VC money would further dilute Lay's stake in the company as well as the stakes of early VC investors, including Tate, an investor in Series A round. Also, another round of venture capital would mean bringing on at least one more board member. After 10 years of investing in the company, the early investors had no more capital available, dry powder in VC slang, to support the company. Tate and Lay both believed that the value of 1939 could increase dramatically, but the company needed more time, more runway, before its cash ran out. Raising growth capital without the additional ownership dilution and governance strings of more venture capital sounded great to Lay. However, he had never heard of venture debt. Tate explained that venture debt was a type of loan that basically promised the assets of the company as collateral, much as a house would be the collateral for a mortgage. Banks lend against the value of a home because of their belief in the borrower's ability to repay the loan, and because they will have a presumably valuable asset to seize if the debt isn't paid off. Venture lenders' thinking is somewhat similar. Loans are made against the enterprise value of the business. Companies use the proceeds for important strategic initiatives, such as shoring up its sales and marketing functions, perhaps making it a more attractive acquisition target, financing a critical aspect of the company's next stage of growth, or making its own strategic acquisition. The use will largely depend on at what stage of its growth the company borrows money. Ultimately, in 2015, 1939 borrowed $30 million from Pioneer Growth Credit Fund, a fictitious venture debt lender. Lay had also investigated taking additional venture capital and had term sheets for equity, making it easy to compare the cost of venture equity versus venture debt. The interest rate on his loans from Pioneer was 10.2%, LIBOR of 0.2% plus 1,000 bips. Raising $30 million in a Series E round at its 2015 valuation of $85 million would have meant doing a down round, where the valuation is lower than the previous round, sending negative signals to investors, employees, and potentially customers and partners, and causing more than 25% dilution for Lay, his management team, employees, and existing shareholders. Using venture debt in 2015 provided 1939 with the $30 million it needed, but resulted in less than 1.5% dilution, the amount needed for warrant coverage. Using equity in 2015 would have been highly dilutive and a down round. Using venture debt in 2015 provided the needed capital with minimal dilution, approximately 1.4% versus greater than 25% with equity. Venture lenders normally ask for a small sliver of equity in the form of warrants to provide upside on their investment, known as an equity kicker. The amount of warrants is calculated using the coverage percentage you negotiate with your lender. For a late-stage company, such as 1939, the coverage would normally be between 2% and 5%. For riskier deals, it could be higher. In the case of 1939, we have assumed a 5% coverage, so the dilution would be calculated as follows. $30 million loan times 5% equals $1.5 million. The amount of equity the lender has the right to buy. This right to buy equity will be documented as a warrant, normally with a 10-year life, allowing the lender to purchase $1.5 million of equity in the most recent round at the price per share of that round. Here, that's $1.5 million at $105 million valuation, or 1.4% dilution. Lay also considered another advantage of venture debt: not having to add another board member in exchange for VC money. The board, consisting of 5 members, was an affable group with good chemistry. Why ruin a good thing? Tate made the case that investing in the research and studies to be able to claim Phelan Fine was effective would be the best use of the $30 million in fresh capital. The rest of the board agreed, and a small team of highly trained scientists was hired. Within 3 years, they shepherded Phelan Fine through the necessary studies, and the food could be marketed for its proven allergen-reducing qualities. By February 2018, the product was ready for the mass market, and an additional $15 million in venture debt was taken on to invest in marketing the food on a wide scale. Because 1939's value had increased and the risk of the loan had decreased, Pioneer Growth Credit was happy to increase the size of its loan and reduce the interest rate spread.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?